Welcome to Your Health, a program that brings you highlights from the health desk here at National Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Davis. Today, antibiotics and pregnancy, what every expecting woman should know, plus the story of one woman's crippling facial pain and her search for a cure. The H1N1 vaccine, is it worth the wait? And a call for healthcare reform on a gas station wall. But first, the swine flu vaccine may have become synonymous with long lines and short supply. So is it worth the wait and the frustration to get vaccinated? NPR's Joanne Silberner has more.
55-year-old Christine Chase of Davis, California, is recovering from swine flu now. She wishes she had gotten the vaccine before getting sick. Her symptoms began with a crashing headache.
It started off that way, then a cough, and then you got really, you know, just felt like the stuffing came out of you, you know, like a hit by a truck feeling, and then incredibly high fever.
Being sick with an H1N1 swine flu infection has made her a positive zealot about the new vaccine.
This has shaken me up, and I'm going to look at the flus a little bit differently now, I'm sure now.
She tells everyone she can to try and get the vaccine. But had Chase been able to get the vaccine before she got sick, would it have saved her from the headache and the fever and the terrible cough? Most probably yes. Tony Fauci heads the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which has run a series of studies on the vaccine's effectiveness. He says blood tests on vaccinated people show they're ready to fight off infection at least as well, if not better, than with seasonal flu vaccines.
You can protect against confirmed influenza in about 70 to 90% of healthy adults who are less than 65 years old, as is always the case.
That's really good, he says.
It is never 100%. It will never be 100%. But it's enough to have a major impact on disease and on the spread of this virus.
But the 70 to 90% number, that's for people under 65. For people over 65, it's different. As we age, our immune systems tend to get weaker. So the vaccine that's supposed to stimulate the immune system to create antibodies to fight off infection cannot do as well. Lisa Jackson is with Group Health Research Institute in Seattle, and she's been studying the effectiveness of this new flu vaccine in older people.
50% of the people in this early look at our studies seem to have enough antibodies that we would think that they would be protected against infection.
That 50% protection is about what you'd expect from regular seasonal flu vaccines. Right now, seniors aren't on the priority list for the new vaccine because they're not getting infected as often. Still, some older people are getting the flu, and when they do, they can get very sick. So Jackson says the vaccine isn't a bad idea.
Once there's a sufficient vaccine supply, seniors are at some risk of infection, and getting the vaccine can only reduce that risk. It is probably warranted for those seniors who would like to reduce their risk of getting H1N1 infection.
And even if it's only 50% protection, that's better than nothing with this new flu, says Christine Chase, who's been struggling to recover. Chase says she would have gotten the vaccine even if doctors could have only offered her a 20 or 30% chance it would work. There is, of course, a caveat to the effectiveness studies. The new flu virus could mutate. Flu viruses do that. That's why there's a new seasonal flu vaccine every year. So far, no signs of that yet, but scientists are watching for it. If the virus mutates into a form the vaccine doesn't fight so well, a new vaccine will be needed. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
When a woman is pregnant, she's more vulnerable to getting sick from viruses like the H1N1 swine flu and from bacterial infections as well. Typically, bacterial infections are treated by antibiotics, including in pregnant women. But there's a new study out which shows that some kinds of antibiotics might be harmful to the fetus. Patty Naiment has this story.
Pregnancy can weaken the immune system, which may be one reason why pregnant women are more vulnerable to bacterial infection. Dr. Brian Mercer heads obstetrics at Cleveland's Metro Health Medical Center.
Pregnant women who develop a bladder infection are more prone to developing kidney infections, and pregnant women who develop pneumonia are at higher risk of complications from the infection itself.
And those complications can harm the developing fetus.
The infections themselves can carry a risk to the fetus because they can cause fever, and fever can lead to miscarriage and birth defects and early labor. Also, infections such as pneumonia can reduce the oxygen supply to the pregnancy and increase the chance for fetal loss.
But there are some cautions with treating these infections. A study this month from the federal government finds most common antibiotics are safe, but it raises a red flag with two types of antibiotics, sulfa drugs like Bactrim and urinary germicides like Macrobid, which are typically used to treat urinary tract infections. In the study, women who had children with birth defects like heart problems, hernias, or a cleft palate were more likely to have taken these medications. Dr. Michael Katz with the March of Dimes says pregnant women shouldn't panic, but they should be careful.
It's reassuring to see that commonly used antibiotics are not problematic, but some of the rarer antibiotics may be. And the key question is the antibiotic needed? And if it is needed, has it been checked for its potential toxicity?
And doctors can do their part, says Katz, by doing a culture and figuring out exactly what type of bacteria is infecting the pregnant woman. Mercer says this is particularly important to do during the first trimester.
The first trimester is the time when the organs are actually developing. It's the time when a heart becomes a heart and lungs become lungs. After that time, much of the pregnancy is taken up with further development of the organs that are already formed.
In New York City, Dr. Mark Evans is an OBGYN and geneticist who specializes in high-risk pregnancies. He says doctors should be aware that certain antibiotics may cause harm.
Everything is a balance between trying to minimize the risk to the fetus on one hand, but on the other hand, not winding up with a very sick mother who in turn will risk the fetus on the other hand. And so it is difficult, and one has to be judicious. And that's why you start with the safest medication that is most likely to do the job.
Bottom line, says Evans, the antibiotics in question were not proved to cause birth defects. Researchers only raised concerns. Evans says further studies are needed. But in the meantime, birth defects remain uncommon, affecting 2-3% of all newborns. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
There's nothing more frightening than the notion that whatever ails you cannot be cured. In this story by John Hamilton, the illness in question is not terminal, but a rare condition that causes facial pain so intense it used to be known as the suicide disease. It's caused by pressure on a nerve that leads from the face to the brain. Here's the story of one woman's desperate search for a cure that would make the pain go away.
People with trigeminal neuralgia tend to have vivid memories of their first severe episode. Sandra McGee was taking a shower.
I just jumped up, you know, fell against the wall, and I started screaming because I was being electrocuted in the shower.
McGee says it felt like the right side of her face had been connected to an electrical outlet. The pain started about an inch above her upper lip.
And it was ricocheting back and forth to my eye. It just kept going back and forth.
The episode in the shower lasted about 45 seconds. It came just a few days before McGee's 50th birthday. McGee lives in the Los Angeles area. She decorates cakes at Costco. And she says that before she got trigeminal neuralgia, she was a pretty happy person. That changed as flashes of pain became more frequent and she realized they could be triggered by almost anything. A gentle touch, a drop of water on her cheek, even a smile.
I couldn't be happy. I couldn't be sad. Because those are all the emotions that you use with your face.
Trigeminal neuralgia is rare. It affects only about 1 out of every 15,000 people. But Neil Martin, the chair of neurosurgery at UCLA, says when it does strike, it can be devastating.
In years past, when we didn't have effective treatments, it was severe enough that some patients would commit suicide to escape the pain.
The pain comes from the trigeminal nerve, which carries sensory information from the face to the brain. There's a place near the brainstem where the trigeminal nerve can get pinched by a blood vessel. Martin says as the blood vessel expands with each pulse, it exerts pressure.
And that pressure, with every heartbeat on the nerve, causes a grinding down or a wearing away of the insulation, the myelin sheath on the nerve fibers, and the patient gets short-circuiting within the nerve. So normal sensation, like touching the face, becomes distorted into a tremendous flash of pain.
In the 1960s, surgeons at UCLA developed an operation to fix the problem. But many patients still don't get surgery because doctors attribute their pain to some other cause, like dental problems. Sandra McGee was pretty sure she had trigeminal neuralgia, but she still agreed to have a root canal redone to see if that would help. She also tried taking powerful painkillers.
And so I took them like every 8 hours, and then it got to be like every 6 hours, then 4 hours, then 3 hours, and I was taking way too much.
So a few months ago, McGee decided it was time to try something else.
I called my insurance and told them what I had and what I need and how bad I need it. And so they recommended me to Dr. Neil Martin at UCLA.
I first met Sandra in early August, and when I saw her, she was having up to 100 episodes a day of sharp, shooting, stabbing, electric shock-like pain. She was in absolute agony. It was completely disabling.
Martin told McGee that surgery was her best hope for permanent relief. He says the surgery still carries risks, but it's become steadily safer and more effective over the years. One major reason is new technologies that create detailed three-dimensional images of a patient's brain. Those images make it easy for surgeons to plan an operation.
Okay, we're going to use this electric drill now to make a small opening in the skull, right on the mastoid.
Martin's surgery on Sandra McGee was recorded on video. He gently teases apart layers of tissue as he works his way toward the brainstem. Within a few minutes, he's exposed the problem.
There it is. It just popped out.
A pulsing red blood vessel has actually worn a visible groove in the white fibers surrounding the trigeminal nerve.
It's just wedged right under there, tight as you would ever see it. And now it's, instead of being under and trapped between the nerve and the brainstem, now it's above the nerve and free.
Martin says at this point in the surgery, he was pretty sure he'd solved the problem. But he wouldn't know for sure until his patient regained consciousness. He and McGee have remarkably similar memories of that event.
She, in the recovery room, woke up quickly.
When I woke up, the first thing that I did is my hand went right to my face.
She still had that look of tension on her face.
Because I knew all my trigger points. And so I was just touching the right side of my face like a crazy woman.
She was making a series of faces that used to cause the pain.
Just to see if it was gone. And it was gone.
It's been nearly 3 months since the surgery, and Sandra McGee says there's not even a hint of the pain that dominated her life for 3 years. She expects to start decorating cakes again next week. John Hamilton, NPR News.
What would you do if you felt wronged by the system, or as in this case, the healthcare system? That's exactly how Regina Holiday felt wronged, and that she wanted to do something about it. So she picked up a paintbrush, found an empty wall just a few miles from the U.S. Capitol, and painted a mural detailing her family's story. NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports.
On a humid day this summer, in a parking lot at the long back wall of a gas station, Regina Holiday stood on a scaffold with her palette of red, black, and blue and started painting a mural. At the center of the mural, there's a dying man, limp in a hospital bed. It's Regina Holiday's husband, Fred.
So here he is, his eyes closed, and he's got a paper in his hand. It says, "Go after them, Regina, love Fred." Because that's what he told me to do.
Fred Holiday wanted Regina to tell the story. He died on June 17th. He was 39 years old with his wife and two young sons. Fred met Regina. She's small with red hair in art class back in Oklahoma. They paint and argue about art, movies, politics, and life. In Washington, Fred taught film classes at a university. Things changed quickly when Fred got sick. It started on Inauguration Day.
So starting in January, like on Inauguration Day, Fred was already in pain. So we went to the doctor, we went to the ER, because he had massive chest pain, and it turned out he had a broken rib. We don't know why we have a broken rib. Maybe it was from coughing. Everybody had that bad cough back in January. Okay, broken rib from coughing.
Only it wasn't just a broken rib. Fred had kidney cancer, and it had spread to the bones of his rib cage. Regina thinks if her husband had had better access to his medical records, he would have gotten better care. The mural tells the story of a horrible day back in the spring. Fred was being transferred to a new hospital, and Regina needed records of Fred's many tests and treatments from the old hospital.
So I had gone down to medical records, because that's what they said. Well, you can go to medical records and request them. And I went down there, and they said, that'll be 73 cents a page and a 21-day wait. I said, my husband is upstairs with stage 4 kidney cancer in your hospital, and you're telling me I have to wait 21 days. Everything's on the computer. All you've got to do is print it out, and you're going to make me wait 21 days. They're like, yeah, that's just the way it is. I was floored.
Regina Holliday says when her husband was transferred to the new hospital, nurses there had to scramble to find someone at the old hospital who could provide the missing records. And as a result, Fred went several hours without treatment or his pain medications.
He was in so much pain. He was crying. He was like, I hurt so bad. And they couldn't even feed him. I had to go down to the local pizzeria, and I had to get him pizza. Because without the correct transfer information, they couldn't feed him.
Over the next 2 months, Regina would see her husband go in and out of hospitals, but there was nothing doctors could do to save his life. 6 days after Fred died, Regina picked up her paintbrushes and started the mural. The brick wall is tucked off a busy avenue. Important players in the healthcare debate drive by every day.
Well, I mean, of course, it's a wonderful therapy and relief to get to paint. To get to do this has been a wonderful dialogue with the public. I mean, people often come over here, they look at the mural, they want to talk about it, and they often share their health stories.
She'd climbed down from her scaffold to hear other people speak with anger and sadness about their own run-ins with doctors, hospitals, and insurance companies. As summer turned to fall and the battle over healthcare heated up, Regina's mural got more political. She added details like a doctor holding a sign that says, "Health Reform Now." The other day, with the last paint dry, there was a nighttime dedication of the mural. A few dozen friends and lots of kids gathered in the parking lot. They held flashlights to shine on the painting. People sang, and Regina answered questions about all the symbolism in the mural. The clock with no hands, because normal time seems suspended in a health emergency. The nurse had a computer with the dark screen, because records aren't shared with patients. The doctor with her hands tied, because one part of the healthcare system doesn't communicate with others.
Okay, that's my question for all of you, is what do we do next? Thank you so much for coming tonight. Thank you so much for being part of Fred's life and my life and spreading the word. And please go out tonight and Facebook and blog and post and tweet and do not stop, do not give up. Until we get change in this nation, until people get taken care of, and we all have the rights to see our own information. Thank you, guys.
Regina Holliday is looking for new walls to paint, but not now. The cold makes the paint too brittle. In the springtime, she'll take out her colors again. Maybe by then there'll be healthcare change signed into law. But there will still be stories to tell. This time, she will paint the stories of others, of the people who've watched her work, and told her about their own struggles as caregivers and patients. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
And that's all for Your Health. Please join us again next week for more of the best from the Health Desk here at NPR. I'm Rebecca Davis, and thanks for listening.